presentation by and conversation with Renata Bethke, whose topic today is the women of the Bonhoeffer family during the Nazi era. Renata's areas of interest are music and psychology, and she has lectured and written widely on the Nazi era, the Holocaust, and Bonhoeffer. She is the niece of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who I was told 50 years ago, April 5th, was put in prison and was killed on April 9th, 48 years ago this week. She's also the wife of Dietrich's closest friend, Eberhard Bethke, who we also welcome today. Eberhard will be speaking tomorrow night on his friendship with Bonhoeffer and Bonhoeffer's theology of friendship at 8:15 at the School of Education. I invite you all to that. Renata has worked with Eberhard in the editing of Bonhoeffer's work and in his works on Bonhoeffer, which all of us are immensely grateful. Renata brings a rich intellectual and cultural history to this conversation and a keen awareness of the destruction unleashed under Hitler. She and her family stand as an eloquent witnesses to the need for people of faith to resist such horror and of the cost of doing so. Lastly, and by no means least, Renata is the mother of three children and the grandmother of six. So please join me in welcoming her warmly.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I nearly feel ashamed about all these good things you have said. I hope I can now live up to what you said. Yeah, it's that I'm speaking on the Bonhoeffer women, as you all know. I know them well, but I will speak about this later. At the 40th conference in Berlin for the 20th of July 1944, which was the anniversary of the failed plot against Hitler, the German-American professor Clemens von Klemperer said, quote, "Attention needs to be called to the courageous family of the conspirators. In my comprehensive study of the resistance, I did not find a single family which did not faithfully support the conspirators. The family as a haven and support has been completely neglected in the literature of the resistance, and the topic is truly important." This is certainly true. And being a haven and support for the men was indeed an important function of these women. But this characterization of their rule seems to me to be too limited, at least for the women in our family, even though they, except for one of my mother's sisters, did not directly participate in planning the conspiracy. They influenced the family judgment of the Nazis as much as the men did. From the beginning, they attentively and indignantly followed the visible injustices taking place. Beyond those, the men had information and insights through their offices, which they usually shared with the women. Thus, they all were convinced that something had to be done against the Nazis, yet that only the men could do it effectively. This was because in the resistance, our family wanted to try to reach the levers of power, places to women to which women had no access in those days. But without the complete support of his wife, hardly any man in the German resistance would have been able to sustain the problems and dangers of resistance activity. Resistance, of course, in Germany was quite something different from resistance in France or any other places, because the Germans, many of them, they felt inclined to Hitler, and they saw the resistors as kind of traitors to their own country. Women often provided the incentive for the activity against Hitler. Such incentive can be sensed, for example, in a 1936 letter from the mother of Adam von Trott zu Solz, who later entered the resistance. The attitude behind this letter reminds me of my grandmother Bonhoeffer, who belonged to the same generation. Eleonora von Trott writes, quote, "If things are to become better, then those who believe in these ideas will have to work for them to the end and say, thy will be done, not in tired resignation as usual, but in light of the overwhelming victorious line which follows on earth as it is in heaven. So, dear Adam, now I have told you what I think about these things." Even though, or rather because, this woman challenged her son to action, you can see immediately that she was in no way a weak or passive woman. But she knew the different roles of herself and her son, and knew that her son had much better opportunities to get something done in the struggle against the Nazis. Eleonore von Trott was even a very strong woman. When her son was condemned to death after the plot of 20th of July, and his small children were taken away from her by the Gestapo, an SS man was surprised that she did not shed any tears. Whereupon she answered, "I have shed all my tears already for the Jewish children." So the woman's role in the resistance in my vicinity looked different than that of the men. The men planned and kept themselves ready for action at the upper level. The women often advised them in this. How important their advice was can be derived, for example, from the consequences of one bit of advice not taken by Berlin's city commander, Paul van Hase, a cousin of my grandmother. His wife, Deta, had warned him about Major Rehmer before the 20th of July. But Hase believed that he could not do without Rehmer in the conspiracy. Yet it was Rehmer who betrayed everything afterwards. Otherwise, in problems with the Nazis, the women felt themselves responsible for the personal arena, for the things which were in their own spheres. There they had good ideas and answers, they were energetic and clear, and cleverly took advantage of a certain fool's privilege women had. They were, however, limited in what they could do by their husband's participation in the conspiracy, to which they could not call attention in any way, but they fully identified with the activities of their husbands. The Nazi policy toward the Jews was a constant topic in our family from the very beginning. It was for our family the strongest reason for entering the resistance. During their interrogations, as they are documented in the interrogation files, my father and Klaus Bonhoeffer named the injustice against the Jews as an important reason for the rejection of the Nazi regime. Out of hundreds of interrogated people, according to these files, only 20 stated the policy toward the Jews as a motive for their resistance. The Nazis were particularly furious at this point. But above all, I want to talk about how the women behaved in daily life during the Nazi time. When I was asked for the first time in a Catholic student center in Berlin, in which I had spoken about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, whether I would also speak about the women in the family, at first I thought there is hardly anything to tell. Looking back from today, it is hard to imagine how much courage was needed for apparently just normal behavior. But this was one of the terrible characteristics of that time. Normal human behavior in many cases was declared by the Nazis as a crime. And often you were treated for it like a criminal. A few weeks ago, one of our newspapers reminded us of such a story. The wife of a professor of Bonn University, Mrs. Kahle, and her student son had helped a Jewess to clear up her shop after this terrible pogrom against the Jews, so-called Christian night on the 9th of November 1938. This, you would imagine, very harmless action was followed by an inflammatory article in the local newspaper that the Kahles had committed treason to their people, that they had placed themselves on the side of the greatest enemy of the National Socialist Germany, the Jews. The house of the Kahles was raided overnight. Mrs. Kahle fled into a convent. A Nazi friend advised her to commit suicide, which she didn't do, though the Carlists fled to England a bit later. Her son and also her husband, who had not even known about the help to the Jews, were excluded from the university. The husband, of course, lost his salary and also his rights as a civil servant, being a professor, to his pension. This is just an example of what could happen after normal human behavior. I will now tell simply of smaller incidents, certainly not heroic ones, which I can remember out of this time. But first I should give an overview of the persons in the family who appear in them. First of all, there were the Bonhoeffer parents, my grandparents. From 1935 on, their house stood directly beside that of my parents, Ursula and Rüdiger Schleicher, in Berlin West End. Earlier in Berlin Grunewald, we had also lived quite near to them. My mother's brother, Klaus Bonhoeffer, also lived nearby with his wife, Emmy. And also, most of the time, her sister, Christine, with her husband, Hans von Donani. Their son is now, some of you may know, a conductor in Cleveland, of the Cleveland Orchestra. All three men were lawyers, and all three men, in the end, were killed by the Nazis. As you know, as well, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was killed. My grandparents so lost two sons and two sons-in-law, and you can imagine what that meant for the women in the family. Dietrich was the only one of the brothers and sisters who was not married, and so always had his room in my grandparents' house next door. So we often saw him, as he was often at home. There was, of course, my great-grandmother, Julie Bonhoeffer. And I shall begin with a story about her, of her. That happened at the boycott of the Jewish stores on the 1st of April 1933, just 2 months after the Nazis had come to govern. Then the order had been given to refrain from buying anything from Jews. My great-grandmother, who was then 90 years old, but still quite vigorous, refused to be intimidated. She broke through a chain of SA-men, stormtroopers, who stood on watch before a well-known Jewish department store, and she left with her purchases in the same way, saying, "I will do my shopping where I always do my shopping." The SA men were stupefied and did not dare to do anything to the old lady. Julie Bonhoeffer was a decided Nazi adversary. When she died 3 years later, Dietrich Bonhoeffer described her in his funeral speech for her. She could not bear it to see the rights of a person violated. Thus her last years were darkened by the grief that she bore about the fate of the Jews in our country, which she suffered with them. She came out of a different time, out of a different spiritual world, and this world will not sink into the grave with her. This heritage, for which we are grateful to her, puts us under obligation. The family had many Jewish friends. Also the husband of one of my mother's sisters, Dietrich's twin sister, Sabine, was of Jewish ancestry, even though he was Baptist already as a baby. There were many Jews, especially in the area of Berlin-Grunewald, in which we all lived until the end of 1935. These Jews, most of whom were wealthy, had fled Germany by the end of 1938. Our family had consulted with these Jewish families, who were our friends, in preparing for the emigration, and had helped them as much as possible, taking care of their children, storing their things, and so on. But above all, simply keeping in contact with them, inviting them over, visiting them, and retaining our Jewish doctors and dentists. The woman particularly took the initiative in keeping these contacts, in which, of course, the men also participated. A few years ago, a Jewish woman in New York, a friend of my mother, told me what that had meant for her and her family, since most of their friends and acquaintances had suddenly begun to avoid them. Some of these Jewish friends showed their gratitude in sending our family care packages after the war, which was very much for us. While we lived near here in Arlington in 1957-58, there was also a family, a Jewish couple, who was very friendly with us. He was an assistant of my grandfather's, and they helped us a lot, and the friendship was going on with us for the whole year. They lived here in Mason Terrace, Brookline. The friendship, the ties of friendship out of the Nazi time were especially strong. Under the pressure and mistrust created by the Nazis, confidence was costly. As Bonhoeffer writes, where we trust, we have learned to put our very lives into the hands of others. We have learned to trust unreservedly. Trust will always be one of our greatest, rarest, and happiest blessings. This applied also and foremost for the family. There was a closeness inside our family which probably would not have existed like that without the Nazis threatening from outside. Here in the family was the basis of trust. You knew, of course, that everything possible was done if something bad would happen to you. But back to the little stories out of daily life. I remember the following well because the Nazi woman it involved, came to my mother after the war and asked her to write a report for her denazification, that she, in spite of her early party membership, had never been a real Nazi. An expression this woman has used much earlier had been so utterly stupid that it had become a sort of catchword in the family. She had a son who attended the same class as my youngest sister. From our district, the children had to walk through a wood to get to school, which meant an adult had to bring them to school. Six mothers, including this Nazi woman, took turns bringing the children to school. A Jewish girl also belonged to this group. One day, this Nazi woman came to my mother and told her that her six-year-old son had such fine racial sentiments that she could not expect him to go with this Jewish girl together to school. Could my mother tell the Jewish mother to go alone with her daughter? To this, my mother answered dryly, that in that case, she had better bring her delicate son to school by herself. Of course, after the war, the Nazi woman had forgotten this story, and she had forgotten that she had always worn the golden swastika, the Nazi party label pin. The people who wore this, you were always afraid to contact a little nearer, because they could, people who would like to report you. The golden pin was even a very special one. When my mother reminded her of that, she answered, but this was only a Germanic runic symbol. At the beginning of the war, Jews in our circles had already immigrated, yet we did get to know one other Jewish family who became victims of the Nazis. The woman was a friend of our long-standing maid. At the maid's request, my mother gave permission for the Jewish woman, this woman with her two children, to come often to our house so that they would have a little more to eat and breathe a bit more freely. Also, the woman helped in the house and so earned some money, which she was not allowed to do as a Jew at this time. That was already during 1941, from then on, when the Jews had to wear the star. So the woman and her children came in the dark in the morning and left in the dark in the evening again. The children could not go into the garden so that they would not be seen. Whenever the doorbell rang while they were in the house, we were frightened that somebody would see them, or worse, had seen them and was coming for them. This went on for several months until they did not come anymore because they were deported. The fate of these people upset us a lot. Somehow, we still had hope for them, even though we suspected that there was not much reason for hope. But we couldn't find a way to hide them with any real prospect of their being saved. In our family, we felt ourselves under observation and in danger anyway, because of the men's work in the resistance. Every time cars parked on the corner near my parents' and my grandparents' houses, or men strolled around our houses for longer periods of time, it made us uneasy. Before the Jews with the stars disappeared from the streets, they could be seen doing hard work, which was meant to humiliate them and which they were often hardly able to do. I still remember an old man, undoubtedly an academic, who for some time swept the streets in our neighborhood. We felt so sorry for him, but only seldom did my mother or the maid dare to pass him something to eat. Across from us lived a Nazi family in which parent and children even greeted each other with Heil Hitler, Vater, Heil Hitler, Rolf. We certainly didn't want to become suspicious to them with such acts. Here it comes to my mind that later on Russian prisoners were kept next door to my grandparents' house. Some of them managed to get out now and then and to look into our trash cans for something edible. My mother then made fried potatoes for them, which of course we didn't have abundantly at this time anyway. They ate them in the garden between my parents and my grandparents' houses. Though they were well hidden from the street by our hedge, the neighbor at the end of our garden managed to observe them. He threatened my parents that he would report them for favoring the enemy if he saw the Russians in their garden again. The next time they came, my father took them into the basement and my mother gave them something to eat there. But back to the Jews who had to work in the streets. My aunt, Christina von Donani, Dohnani, the son calls himself, was once waiting with her son, my cousin, at a bus stop. There they saw a Jew who was trying in vain to push a heavy wheelbarrow over a threshold. My cousin told how my aunt ran over and helped him bring the wheelbarrow over the threshold. Such small and normal human acts at this time were considered outrageous and could be dangerous if they were seen by a Nazi. The women in our family had to be very careful with such spontaneous acts in light of the political activities of their husbands, especially Christina von Donani, who knew a lot of details about the conspiracy, might have endangered not only herself but also her husband and wider circles in the conspiracy. There was a kind of courage in the wrong places which caused everyone to shake their heads as is foolhardiness. The balance between courage and prudence in general was difficult and important. In the beginning, our people were more angry at those who lacked courage, later on at those who lacked prudence, who were not careful. Even in the Confessing Church in 1940, nobody was pleased about the incautious statements of Dean Stemmler, who was generally an excellent man. They brought him a year in prison and additional difficulties to the Confessing Church. Nevertheless, there were cases when courage simply had to take precedence over prudence. Everyone had to decide for themselves when such a case presented itself. For example, Dieter von Haase, whom I have already mentioned, wife of General von Haase, who had been executed shortly after the plot of the 20th of July, had also been arrested and her house had been confiscated. When she was released from prison out of such prudence, close relatives of her did not take her in. In despair, she finally came to my parents. As I said, her husband was my grandmother's cousin, who took her in as a matter of course. As she wrote later in her memoirs, my father said to her, "It is an honor to us that you come here." Shortly after this, my father was arrested and taken to prison, which he was never to leave again. Whether that had to do anything with her being with us, it's very doubtful. I myself had a bad experience with false courage when I was 15 or 16 years old. together with a Nazi girl, I was representative, class representative for my class. She was basically a nice girl, so that one day I thought I could enlighten her about the Nazis. She, however, was completely horrified, and she told me that she was very sorry, but she would have to report me. It was wartime, she said, and she could not be responsible for me to be at large with such defeatist opinions. Everything possible had to be done to help the victory. Fortunately, during the last class period, she had a saving idea. If she could convince me that what I had told her was wrong, then she would not have to report me. The next day, she brought to school Hitler's Mein Kampf and other material in which she had underlined a lot. During the breaks, we sat down together, and of course, I was quickly converted. You can see from this how dangerous it was to tell children about what the Nazis were really doing, not to mention telling them about the resistance. Various sets of parents in the family differed a little in how they handled this. I think my parents told us quite a lot simply to prevent us from falling for the Nazis. Also, we heard a lot in my grandparents' house next door, where the adults nearly all the time were talking about politics. The Donani children, my cousins, who were the closest to us in age, were kept at a somewhat greater distance from these issues, certainly primarily because their father worked so centrally in the conspiracy. Though we were in the Hitler Youth, only a little later than the normal age, my parents tried to keep its influence as small as possible. My mother arranged for me a doctor's certificate that I had a weak heart and so could not take part very often. My brother with his cello was brought into the Hitler Youth Radio Music Group, where hardly anything else was done except play classical or old folk music. My parents did not allow my younger sister, who was elected to be a girls' leader, to accept the selection for health reasons, as was said. We all were never allowed to take part in Hitler Youth courses or camps. Even for our dancing lessons, children were chosen from families who thought similarly. All this was organized primarily by my mother. After my final school exam, I would have been drafted to work in the war labor service. Every girl after the final school exam had to go there. A favorable opportunity to stay out of it appeared, getting married. As I was young in my class, only 17, my parents did not like that solution very much, but they thought that it was the smaller evil, which it might have been. Even before I got my high school diploma, the civil wedding certificate had to be submitted. So Dietrich Bonhoeffer could still be our witness at the civil ceremony short before he came to prison. We married probably 2 months later then, when he was already in prison. These were everyday occurrences and problems with which our family and those few others opposed to the Nazis had to live. The details for the decisions made were different, depending on their importance for the individual involved and the extent of his or her anxiety or necessary prudence, which was sometimes hard for the individuals themselves to figure out. Characteristic for that situation, Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote, it is necessary in the given situation to observe, to weigh up, to assess, and to decide. One's task is not to turn the world upside down, but to do what is necessary at the given place and with a due consideration of reality. At the same time, one must ask, what are the actual possibilities? It is not an absolute good that is to be realized, but on the contrary, it is part of the self-direction of the responsible agent that he prefers what is relatively better to what is relatively worse, and that he perceives that the absolute good may sometimes be the very worst. The absolute good that I don't make myself dirty, I don't do anything, which is perhaps not quite in line with law, the special laws the Nazis made. These thoughts are particularly related to active political resistance to the conspiracy, but they also apply to smaller daily decisions. Both were intertwined. Even small refusals, which today would seem ridiculous, back then could have endangered life and were basically resistance. My husband once developed a typology of different stages of resistance, which have been used in other studies and which appear plausible to me. The first stage he called simple passive resistance. The second one, open ideological resistance, which after the communists had been wiped out, came, if at all, mainly from the churches, and there, of course, under strong support of women. The third is complicity in knowing about the coup preparation. The fourth, preparation for what should come after a coup, which was done particularly in the so-called Kreisau circle, Moltke, York, Trott. Moltke I mentioned before. The fifth was then the active conspiracy. Women participated in stages 1 to 3. Stages 4 and 5 were done almost exclusively by men. Somewhat of what I have talked about fits into stage 1, passive resistance, such as subverting Nazi commands, not excluding Jews, helping them with small things, although that could not really be counted as passive resistance, considering the danger involved. I would now like to speak about stage 2, open ideological resistance as far as it concerns the church, and particularly about my grandmother Bonhoeffer's involvement, even though, unfortunately, it can be only partially reconstructed. I have very strong memories of her intense interest in everything which affected the so-called church struggle, especially in the first years of Nazi rule. In May 1934, the Confessing Church was founded, which was a group in the church which worked against the Nazification of the church, had of course been active long before this date. In the first years, there was still hope that supporting the Confessing Church would be politically effective. It was then the only organization which offered the Nazis any resistance after all other independent or adversarial organization had been either simply outlawed or integrated into Nazi organizations. So some Protestants, who in so far had not taken much interest in the life of the church besides just paying their church taxes, now became quite loyal to the Confessing Church. In doing so, they also hoped to give support to those few non-Nazis in the government left from the Weimar Republic, for instance, the Minister of Law, Gürtner, and Neurath, the foreign Secretary of State, it was. Dietrich Bonhoeffer described this later in his ethics manuscript this way. All remaining elements of order seek proximity to the church. Justice, truth, science, art, culture, humanity, liberty, patriotism, after long straying from the past, are finding their way back to their source. The political aspect of the Confessing Church was very important to my grandmother. She always kept informed about the political situation. Later, she never missed the news on the BBC radio for a single day, which was, of course, strictly forbidden. On the other hand, she was a conscious Christian, the daughter and granddaughter of well-known theologians. Even though in her adult years she had not been a regular churchgoer. Now she often drove to Martin Niemöller's church in Dahlem, one of the centers of the Confessing Church, and sometimes she took us children along. As far as I can remember, my grandfather did not take part in these church visits. He was interested in the Confessing Church, but otherwise not particularly close to the church. Conversations with my grandmother and my grandparents' house constantly concerned church politics. My grandmother subscribed to the Confessing Church journal Junge Kirche, Young Church, and discussed the articles and what the church should or should not do. My uncle Dietrich Bonhoeffer and his friend and colleague, Franz Hildebrand, were the main participant in such discussions. But also my mother, Ursula Schleicher, her sister, Christine von Delany, and their youngest sister, Susanne Dress, were strongly involved. I can still remember names of leading confessing church pastors like Jacobi, Asmussen, Alberts, Niesel, and of course Niemöller, and others from this time. They must have seemed to me to be a sort of superman. After the war, when I met one or the other of them, I was disappointed to find such just normal people. Since I was still rather young in this early Nazi time, I do not remember many details. But I know that the most important point with my grandmother, mother and aunts was that the church had to do something for the Jews, also for the Jews who did not belong to the church. Like these women, from the very beginning, Dietrich had expressed such thoughts, he doing it also publicly, and these thoughts were not particularly welcome either in church or in society. I also remember a family discussion on withdrawing from the church, which seemed to me rather strange. This happened after the church had introduced the so-called Aryan paragraph at the so-called Brown Synod in Berlin in September 1933. There it had been decided that the church was no more to employ persons of Jewish descent. In our circle, they debated now whether, in protest, they should found a free church. But that would only have worked if whole parishes had gone along with it. There are hardly any free churches in Germany, and they don't play any role. So they decided to continue to struggle within the church. When only 3 weeks later, the National Synod took place in Wittenberg, where none of the adversaries of the Aryan paragraph was allowed to speak, Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Franz Hildebrand clandestinely distributed temples and posted them on houses and trees. My grandmother had discussed this with them and gave them the car to make the whole undertaking easier for them. I think Eberhard wrote in his book that the father gave them his car. The father, of course, consented, but this kind of decision and the talking about this was also done, always done by the mother. Dietrich soon after this went as a minister to a German congregation in London, from October 1933 to April 1935. During that time, it was his mother who kept him informed about political and church political events. Which happened in Germany. She got her information through her church contact and also through the big family. The men often provided secret news from their ministry. Dietrich then usually passed the information directly to the Bishop of Chichester, George Bell, whom he knew from his ecumenical work. Bell, entitled to a seat in the House of Lords as a bishop, had good links to the press. Thus, such information sometimes appeared in the next days London Times. In the family, we soon had developed a kind of code language so that we could tell each other a lot without the Gestapo being able to understand what was really meant. For example, if the police had searched Niemöller's house, we said, yesterday Martin has had visitors. For prison, we said hospital. The word for war became Uncle Rudy. That was the husband of my grandmother who had been a general in the First World War. When my grandmother went to hear the BBC news, she said, it's time now for devotions. This kind of code language was also spontaneously invented and understood. Some time ago, I found a letter written in such code language from my grandmother to my uncle in London. Here one can see how involved she was in church politics. She wrote, I will go later today again to Gerhard to discuss with him what he thinks about your coming together with Georg. Franz Hildebrand, you should. I thought it would be better if he came later or perhaps earlier. I will write soon what Gerhard thinks. The point in question seems very clear to us. With Gerhard, she means Gerhard Jacobi, the prominent confessing church minister at the Kaiser Wilhelm Memorial Church in Berlin. Georg is George Bell, the Bishop of Chichester. They were planning that Bell should visit an important political official, perhaps even Hindenburg, who was still Reichspräsident. My grandmother had contacts to him through the aforementioned Uncle Rudi, who had been a general within Hindenburg in the First World War. My grandmother wanted to discuss with Jacobi when and how Bell's visit could be most effective for the confessing church as a help. Also, the next letter about this no longer exists. There may not have been one, and the matter may have been pursued on the telephone. This letter goes on like a family letter from my grandmother to Dietrich, but it speaks about an important event in church politics. The event in question was the pastor's emergency league, which opposed the Arian paragraph that ministers of Jewish descent were not allowed to be ministers anymore, and supported its victims, had been dissolved under pressure in Württemberg province, this pastor's emergency league. For the Nazi Reichsbischof Ludwig Müller, this was a big success. And he tried now to reach the same in other provinces. My grandmother in her letter tells this to Dietrich as if it was a family affair. She writes, "It is a pity that the boys in Württemberg have dissolved their circle, the pastor's emergency league. Now Uncle Ludwig Müller, the Reichsbishop, as the oldest of the family, is going to send a letter to all relatives urging them to join him." He was trying now to get the other churches in the other provinces, which he didn't succeed. The letter is really longer. My grandmother is also foreseeing that he would fail with this. Franz Hildebrandt, who was with Dietrich in London for some time, told of the many telephone calls between Dietrich and his mother, sometimes daily. Once the phone bill was so astronomically high that the two went in despair to the telephone office. There the lady understood completely that they could not pay such a bill and cut it in half for them. I think I better have to leave out. From the beginning of the war years, and increasingly as the war dragged on, everyone in the family was totally absorbed with war events and what was going on behind them. The deportation of the Jews, hopes and disappointment in the conspiracy, and after April 1943, the events linked with the arrest of my uncles, Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Hans von Donani. Also, my aunt Christine von Donani was arrested for 5 weeks. In addition, there were the steady air raids and the constant repairs on the houses they made necessary. After the failed plot against Hitler on the 20th of July 1944, my father and Klaus Bonhoeffer were arrested, and finally, my husband, who had been a soldier in Italy, was also. The tension about the progress of the interrogation, even while we had hoped for the plot at first, and then for a quick end to the war and Nazi rule, kept our minds in high gear. My aunt owes her relatively quick release from prison mainly to being a woman. Of course, the good preparations and arrangement among the people involved, as well as her own considerable intelligence, helped. She very cleverly used the fact that women, without further ado, could be seen as obtuse. During her interrogation, she gave quite stupid answers and made narrow-minded remarks so that the interrogators believed in her role as a naive and rather simple housewife. I could read to you a letter, but I don't know whether it's time. Maybe in which she wrote out of the prison. That's very good and courageous. As a matter of fact, my aunt was very well informed about the planning of the conspiracy. Thus, according to the stages of resistance I outlined before, she should be assigned to stage 3, complicity, partially even to stage 5, active conspiracy. Our family was less occupied with stage 4, planning for what was to come later. They felt that preoccupation with that was a sort of escape from what had to be done first, achieving the coup. Hans von der Nani had shared almost everything with his wife. So when after the war, some false reports from other survivors appeared, even about Hans von Nani's role, Christine could clarify some of what had really happened. Afterwards, marginal people had enlarged their own role at the expense of the main conspirators, who were dead, of course. So some years ago, Count von Thun-Hohenstein, in his biography of Hans Oster, criticized Hans von der Nani for telling his wife so much. Vernichtet.
Destroyed.
But they wanted to keep it for as proof for after the war. So they didn't do it, and it was found and was fatal. Hans von der Nani wrote out of prison on a clandestine paper, they know all but everything. They know everything but everything. In addition to her advice, Christine had been useful to the conspiracy in many different ways. As a harmless woman, she could receive and pass coded news, she could cover up secret talks in her house, she wrote certain things secretaries were not supposed to see, and could deliver them without arising suspicion. Sometimes also the other women in the family were used for errands and passing messages, which had to be done as inconspicuously and reliably as possible. When the men were taken to prison, the women, of course, were challenged more strongly. In the first weeks, when my aunt was also imprisoned, a lot of responsibility fell on my mother. For the 3 Donati children, even though the oldest was already 16 years old, and for contacts to the prisons, especially the one where my aunt was, strange guard women from my aunt's prison appeared and brought all greetings from her with requests for food, beddings, and other things, which were impossible to get and hard to spare at the time. But of course, my mother gave them whatever they wanted, though she could not know whether anything would really reach my aunt. When my aunt was back home, most of the responsibility fell on her. She had the best overview of things, and she also knew who in important positions could influence the course of the legal cases. My father and Klaus Bonhoeffer also tried various things to help before they were imprisoned themselves. My mother too kept contact with General von Haase to exchange news about prison matters and did other errands. Christine was then during the days mostly in my grandparents' house. Her parents, of course. She, they, and my mother, and the men were always at work, and she and my mother, the men were away at daytime. And often the youngest sister, Susanne, who lived in another part of Berlin, constantly discussed the legal situation. The problems included defense counsel and interventions. By using official channels through my grandfather, who was internationally respected as a scientist, and secret ones through go-betweens, also my father and Klaus, and facilitating better conditions in custody. We nearly grown-up children were sometimes used to look through the book which were returned from the prisons, mainly Dietrich's, for hidden messages. The adults had previously arranged a code. If the name of the book's owner was underlined, then there was a message in the book. Then we had to look for a very little pencil point on every second page, starting from the end of the book. Later, for caution's sake, the name was not always underlined and the points were made irregularly every several page from the back. The points were very inconspicuous and hard to differentiate from other little specks in the paper. We were only sure it was a pencil point if we could rub it out. Then we would set a new point so that in the end we could put the words together. The messages thus received, of course, brought new consideration for the adults. Also, when they came from Dietrich, they were often passed on in the same way to Hans and vice versa. In addition, the Donanis had an unbelievable method of sending each other long letters. With a super sharp pencil, they wrote in tiny writing on small round papers, which they had cut to fit exactly the bottom of a jar. The papers were put in, and on top a second bottom was inserted, and then the jar was filled with some not-too-wet pudding or the like. At the time, I had not known about these letters. I only saw them much later. Christine also sent her husband diphtheria bacilli in such a jar after he had asked for them to make him unable to be interrogated or to make the commissars afraid to come near to him. Must have been something which was catching. She requested the bacilli from a trustworthy former assistant of my grandfather and put them in a pudding, which she marked according to the arrangement with her husband. This was terrible for my aunt, but she did what she had to do without complaining. Hans then became very ill, but he simulated beyond the actual illness. In the end, he hoped to escape, and my aunt planned a way. But it did not work out. They did not dare to undertake it, as special guards were put on watch. Dietrich also had planned an escape after the 20th of July. One of his guards came to my mother and told her that he would smuggle Dietrich out of prison disguised as a plumber. My parents somehow got hold of a plumber suit. It was very difficult all in this time. Together with me, to make the whole adventure look like an outing, they brought it far out to a suburb of Berlin, where this guard was working in his allotment garden. A few days later, Klaus Bonnevere and my father were imprisoned, so that Dietrich then rejected to escape the escape plane in order not to further endanger the family. He was then transferred to the infamous Gestapo prison in the Prinz Albrecht Straße. Klaus Bonnevere's wife and children had long since left Berlin because of the air raids, and Klaus then spent a lot of time at my parents' house. He always went home overnight, of course. He was arrested at my parents' house. On returning home from a work, he had seen the Gestapo waiting in front of his house and had fled to my parents, who then debated with him the whole night to prevent him from committing suicide. The next morning, the Gestapo came for him. My father was arrested in his office in the Air Ministry 3 days later. His assistant, Dr. Hans John, was arrested with him and was later condemned to death and shot by the Nazis together with my father and Klaus. They had all the same trial. When my father was arrested, of course, the most difficult time began for my mother. She went now to various men in the Nazi offices to get improvements in the condition of my father's permission to read and to write, only given after several requests, permission to visit that was given much later. In those offices, one had to wait a long time standing up. Sometimes one was sent home after a long wait without even seeing the person in question. Klaus's wife, Emmy, came back to Berlin after she had arranged for her children's care and undertook similar missions for him. I, of course, had to do the same thing for Ewald, then a little later, but for me it was not quite as difficult. He had been in Italy before as a soldier, and so I was happy that he was now nearer and not so far away in Italy. And as he was not this much involved, I had from the beginning a good hope that he would come out again. Soon now, my mother and Emmy Bonnevere had to look for defense counsel for my father and Klaus because the date of their trial had been fixed then. We were advised not to take the same one for the two men. The so-called People's Court, which was to try their cases, had only 12 official defense lawyers. We were allowed to choose only among these 12 men. They, of course, were all extreme Nazis and had no wish to do anything for likely enemies of the regime. Yet the women inquired around who might perhaps be a little better than the others. My mother went with me to see Neubert, the one we finally chose for my father. He was a shady, probably weak man with no conscience, and we tried in vain to interest him in my father's case. As others had advised us, we gave him, or rather left there, a bottle of liquor. It was worth a fortune at this time, but we had no experience at such things. Anyway, it did not help. The official defense counsel for Klaus Weimann was of the same quality. He just did nothing. After the death sentences for my father and Klaus, the women feverishly started new activities. Immediately the next morning, my mother went with my sister to the People's Court to appeal the judgment. Also, my grandparents set out the same morning to deliver Dietrich's birthday parcel to the Gestapo prison. Then came one of the worst daytime bombing raids, and I still remember the condition in which my grandparents came home, exhausted and blackened with soot and dust. My mother described this morning spent during the raid in a station near the People's Court in a letter to my brother, who was in the Air Force at the time. My father's brother, a doctor in the army, had come to Berlin and was also on his way to the People's Court on my father's behalf when the bombing began. When a doctor was called for, he answered and found the call was for Preissler, the chief judge of the People's Court, who had condemned Klaus and my father the previous day. He had died in the raid, and my uncle was supposed to write his death certificate, but he declined, saying that this man had condemned to death his brother innocently yesterday. After this, new appeals for mercy were drafted and written. My mother also turned to my father's colleagues and asked them to intercede for him. With a few praiseworthy exceptions, the answers she received or did not receive at all were astonishing evidence of cowardice. When she visited the wife of one of these colleagues, with whom we were well acquainted, nearly friends, as from family to family, the woman did not let her come in the house, saying, "My husband has forbidden me to speak with you." Now a little back. From the beginning, my father and Klaus had been imprisoned in the same jail. A month later, my husband, who had been a soldier in Italy, was also arrested. He was put into the same prison in Berlin, Lehrter Street. Somehow, my mother managed to have food ready for all of them every day, which was nearly a miracle at the time. It was possible because acquaintances and even some people whom we did not know out of the confessing church brought us ration stamps they could spare, and of course, we ourselves sorted whatever we could for the prison. Once a wild rabbit got lost in our basement. Our help caught it, and to my horror and respect, made a roast out of it for the prison. Usually, we made a hot lunch for the men and put it in very hot bowls, which we wrapped in newspaper and shawls. Two of us women set off to prison, then with the three parcels. That was the easiest to make hot lunches because anything substantial like butter or it was not so much there, but something hot one could somehow manage. We also sent butter, but not as much as we would have liked. Actually, delivering food like this was not allowed. In the other prisons, food delivery was permitted every 10 days, or at best, every week. But in this prison, somehow the things were accepted every day. Perhaps partly out of kindness, perhaps partly thinking about the end of the war, that they would have somebody who would speak well about them, probably mostly because the wardens at the door would also get two cigarettes or something else they liked. Once when we had just delivered the food, some Gestapo men arrived to take prisoners to their interrogation. They screamed at us terribly that we had better disappear and that we ourselves would be locked up if they ever saw us here again. But we tried again the next day, albeit fearfully, and the wardens accepted the things as usual. Emmy was very strong in this, and so I went along. I don't know whether I alone might have done this again after that. We were afraid that the Gestapo men might reappear, but they usually came at other times, and we never saw them again. At the end, when the Russians were already at the edge of Berlin, it became nearly impossible to get through to the prison. We were no longer allowed to use the city train. Only my grandfather, as a doctor, got a special permit for it. With that permit, I wrote one last time to the prison on the 21st of April 1945. There was already so much turmoil that I did not worry about being caught. This last city train ride is a terrible memory for me. The cars were full of wounded soldiers. Somehow, however, the feeling that the Nazi time really was coming to an end strengthened our hope that the prisoners could survive through the remaining days. But Dietrich and Hans were already dead, and my father and Klaus were shot 2 days later. We found out about all that much, much later. Eberhard was searching for it, and he found most of it. On the 25th of April, the Russians got far enough into the city that the last prisoners persuaded the wardens to open the prison gates for them, and my husband came home. They were told that the others had been transferred to another prison, but we already sensed the worst. Where should they transfer them? There was whole Germany now occupied. So that we can have a little discussion. Now, at the end, I would like to tell you a little about Bonhoeffer's fiancée. In Germany last fall, the letters between him and her, Maria von Wedemeyer, came out and have already the third edition. They also will appear in English, but this is only, translation is only starting. The engagement was made public only in the family when Dietrich was already in prison. Already in the fall of the year before, 1942, Dietrich has hoped for the engagement. But Maria's mother had asked him to wait a year, as Maria was only 18, and only a short while ago her father and her brother had been killed in the war. So for the mother it was not easy to have all the responsibility alone now, and Dietrich did not want to exploit this situation. Dietrich was not even supposed to see her for that year. Yet Maria wrote him in January 1943 that she was accepting his proposal and wanted to marry him, yet wait for the time that the mother has set. But when Dietrich was imprisoned nearly 2 months later, with the consent of her mother, Maria, now being 19, tried to get into contact with him and so came to visit his parents and got in touch with all of our family. She often came to Berlin to bring things for Dietrich, and from July on, she sometimes was permitted to visit him. She then also visited my grandparents and us in the house next door. There was a visit only then. My grandparents gave up some of their permission so that Maria could go. At first it was very strict, one could only go very seldom, and only the parents and the bride. I would like to read to you now just some small pieces out of the new book, The Letters Between Dietrich and Maria, in my own not very good translation. After her visit in prison, Maria had told her mother about the situation there. As always, a guard sat with them, looked at them, and listened what they said. Mother and grandmother apparently had proposed, in order to overcome that difficulty, that Dietrich should give her a little sermon. To this proposal, they both wrote, both in the same attitude. Their letters cross each other. Now I will just read out of the both letters. First, Dietrich. You know, dear Maria, your mother visited me yesterday. She proposed, apparently after grandmother's suggestion, that I should give you a short interpretation of something out of the Bible. She thought that you should come with some questions about which we should speak. Look, Maria, this doesn't work, and it would be alien to me and unnatural. We must make something out of the short time we have. No, that is impossible. It certainly is not so that I want something very special, great, important from you in this hour. We both know what we do in the morning and in the evening. They wrote that they prayed for each other all that in the morning and all in the evening at a certain time. But I very simply want you the way you really are and without any stain in self-consciousness. That is much more important and greater than all other important and great things, because it is real life as it comes out of the hands of God. Sure, one of our meetings is more satisfying than the other. But is not life itself like that? And is it not the most important that we are together, just as we are, and as we later want to live together? And Maria writes a day later, I often think about my permissions to visit. Of course, she had his letter that took weeks usually until it arrived. I often think about my permissions to visit. Mother and grandmother recently spoke about it, and now each of them writes to me how I should organize a next visit. It is very kindly thought out for you and for me. I cannot take it apart in detail, but you should tell me. Is it really so important that we talk about profound stuff? That we tell each other our opinions and beliefs about the most important parts one doesn't want to speak? Yes, of course it is important, yet there is something much more important. I don't know whether you feel the same, but for me it's the most important that I can sit next to you only a very short time, and yet it keeps me over the weeks that I'm lonely here. So far. There would be much more which I would like to read to you, how Maria tells Dietrich about the books she likes and how Dietrich answered that he does not think much of some of those books. And how Maria tells him quite positively that probably he did not read those books well enough. Or how they plan their future life, their wedding, their furnishing, the education of their children, and of course, how they try to cope with their difficult situation now. For the end, I read to you a quote from a letter of Dietrich to Maria in April 1944. Quote now. You recently wrote about how little we retain of something good and beautiful when once it is over and gone. I struggled often with such thoughts myself, especially at the beginning of this last year. But I have found that it is very dangerous and wrong to entertain such thinking. We must not lose our past. It belongs to us and should remain part of ourselves, otherwise we fall into discontent and depression. We have to take everything in our past and purify it again and again in the waters of gratitude and contrition. This is a way for us to gain and to hold on to what is past. To be sure, it is past, but it is my past, and as such, it remains present for me through profound, selfless gratitude for God's gifts and through contrition for our own perversity, which spoils those gifts again and again. In this way, we can recall the past without self-torment and even draw strength from it. Everything in our past stands under God's favor and God's forgiveness. Thank you very much.
Renata has kindly offered to answer some questions, so if those of you would like to ask her anything specifically. While everybody's thinking, I guess I would wonder, it was very helpful to me, since I wasn't even alive then, to get a very sense of the day-to-day kind of tensions and frustrations that all of you had. As I think now, when I watch the news of Germany and the Nazi imagery that gets conjured up, I wonder if you could speak to that, of how it is for you, having lived through what you did, to experience some of what...
What is happening now, you mean? Mm. That is difficult to say. I think one should not over-emphasize it. The people who are now making the noise, they are called Nazi. Of course, in a way, it is some of the same thing, but they have their own problems. They have lived, most of them, of course, in the East is much stronger than it was in the West. They have lived under this pressure of the communists, and now being forced to be totally left, now they jump over to the quite the other extreme. And some of them, they just try how far they can go. Of course, then the real problem is the many, many people from the East who are streaming to Germany. There is no work for many, many people in East Germany, also in the West, but in East it's all much worse. And they think we have nothing. They all come in and want something here too. They are worried about their future. Of course, these things, these crimes that they do, and this fire they set to houses where these people live, that this is something terrible. But I think there are so many people who now are demonstrating against it and who really hate this and think it's terrible. I don't think they will really come up in a bad way. But of course, it's worrying. That is no question.
Obviously, when your aunt was arrested, Christine, and your father, what happened to the children?
The Donani children, the oldest was 16. Of course, my mother then was mostly in charge, also the grandparents, but when my aunt rides out of prison and she sends the guards woman to my mother, my mother took over, she told what was to be done. And then a sister of my grandmother, she came to live in the house where the Donanis lived. They lived outside Berlin, very near, but three quarters or half an hour from where we lived with the bus. And so then this old aunt came to live with them. But first they were just with us in our house. And, yeah, of course. I mean, she was, they searched the house. And but usually they left the women. I mean, with my aunt, they took had the right idea to take her, but then she turned out to be what they expect a woman to be. This was quite good. And I mean, the women of these other people, like Hase, this general von Hase, who was a commander of Berlin, they left her out again too, and she had known quite something. So usually they didn't keep them for very long. They took the children, not the Donani children, but some other children that took, and they want to change them, the smaller children.
This is a question about conspiracy and its knowledge in the family. You've told us how Hans confided in your aunt details of conspiracy. Do you think that your father also confided in your mother in a similar way? Do you think that your father knew of his confidences in the Donani family? And at what point did you yourself come to know? You described yourself as being in stage three, I take it, at least in the family in stage mm-hmm. three. Mm-hmm. What point did you yourself come to know details of the conspiracy?
The real details were never put open to us, but I mean, there was always talk about that something had to happen. Then Klaus Bonhoeffer, he came often home to either to my parents or to my grandparents and said, "Es knistert im Gebälk." I mean, something is moving. It's coming. It's going on. And, we knew. He also mentioned some names. It stuck in my memory that, for instance, Prince Louis Ferdinand. The son of the Kaiser, he was also involved there. And we knew that from the Donanis, I mean, the family knew quite a lot, but not when what was happening. We knew that something was planned, and when there was something due, you sensed it, because it was the waiting for the phone and this kind of thing short before my grandfather had his 75th birthday, then there was something in the making. That was to, I could feel that. But we were never told the single things. And I mean, my aunt Donani, she knew and she gave also some advices. Hans Donani was central and also was this this cousin of my grandmother. My father was not so central, but of course he was also in the planning and in the planning for after the plot. He had consented to do something and help. He was a bit different kind from type from Hans Donani. Hans von Donani, you could imagine that he was a conspirator. My father, he was more an artistic person. He had the perfect pitch and liked his violin, and he was very open, while Hans Donani was very reserved. So my father couldn't lie. That was also something very difficult, and sometimes he was laughed at in the family. They said when he couldn't lie and had difficulties, and they said, "You are really from the last century." He was born before the turn of the century, and the others after. So my father was a different kind of person. He helped, but and was very. Terrible about the Nazis. Already when Hitler came, I know how very depressed he was and said that means war again. But he was not the type of conspirators. Yet he did what he could, but I don't think he would ever have told my mother things. Special things. Though they, of course, they talked over it. My mother was a much more, she could keep things to herself better than he. So I don't know.
In terms of Dietrich Bonhoeffer in prison, and were the women used, you say mostly Christina, but were the women used to bring information into him about, for example, the date of the July 20th plot? Who would be used among the women?
To bring this to Dietrich. That was very strange. Usually the people in prison knew themselves, sometimes even before we outside knew. Somehow they had links
in
prison from visitors with code. We knew very strangely. We knew before the end of the war. We knew exactly from prison. I don't know whether we got it through Eberhard or through Klaus or through my father, how Berlin would be partitioned. That came out of prison, and we thought. But it was exactly right. That was the way it happened afterwards. So I don't know how that soaked in, but somehow.
And you think Dietrich knew in prison before the July 20th plot?
I don't know whether he knew before, but certainly he knew and while that happening. I mean, he was allowed to hear radio. After this Paul von Hase, this commandant of Berlin, he had visited him once in prison. And from then on, he was a very special prisoner because he was a commandant of Berlin. And he then was allowed now and then to get out of his cell. He could listen to the radio. When also he was being a son of a medical doctor, he was taken. They had sometimes bed. The prison was hurt by bombs and so. And then he was taken down when somebody was hurt to advise medically what to do, and he helped there. So
it was a military prison, not a Gestapo prison.
Yeah, but there were many Gestapo. They all were under the Gestapo head, but the watchmen were, most of them were just normal prison guards, of course very bad ones in it, but there were some very good ones. And they, for instance, they brought out the correspondence, which came out as letters and papers from prison, there was one, two guards, as a matter of fact, first the one and then the other one, who gave their address for Eberhard to write, and they took the letters of Dietrich and posted them with their own name on it as, in the back. So there were some good people and who were impressed apparently by the by Dietrich as a person, and who helped them, and who also the after the visit of this uncle, this General von Haase, even the commandant of the prison, the top man, he sometimes rang my grandparents after air raids and asked for Dietrich whether our houses were still all right, and told my grandmother that that everything was all right in prison so that she needn't worry. That was for some time then quite good, and then it was possible for sometimes to have extra visits. One of these guards, they would then tell, for instance, when Eberhard came from the front to baptize our first son, then Dietrich gave him through one of the guards a ring that he should come at a certain time at the door, and behind there was a proper man who would just make an exception and let him in without any permission. So there were things which are out of the ordinary, which could be done there. For he was there so long. I don't know who was first now.
I was just curious, have you lived in the United States for many years now, or not at all?
No, not for many years. We have been, first we have been here 1 year, 1957 to 58. And we have lived in England for a long time, for 8 years. But luckily we are invited now and then, like here. And we are always very happy. We like it to be here.
The reason I asked is I'm just curious how this experience has informed the rest of your life. And you seem like such a positive person. You must always be working for a good cause. And there's so many sort of periods that the United States has gone through since then, which seem like almost on the verge of Nazism, like the McCarthy era. People's Park in California. I don't know if you kept up with any of those things.
The McCarthy, that was when we were here, that was just then, uh-huh. In this early time, 57, 58, there it started, or it was, anyway, it was happening, and some people were very unhappy about it. I mean, for us, we are rather sober. Of course, we also felt the danger, and we were very happy when how you could cope with this, and how you coped with it. Somehow, why you could cope with it and why we couldn't, I don't know. But of course, there are certain things in German history, some values which were very bad for this. For instance, the value of obedience, which you luckily don't have.
Can I ask a couple of von Haase questions? One is, in connection with Paul von Haase's involvement with the conspiracy, were you, as one of the younger ones, aware of that involvement? And secondly, I think you mentioned that after his execution, members of the family were reluctant to take Frau von Haase in. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that was because of disapproval of his involvement or because of their own being hesitant about what would happen to them.
Frightened. I think both. There were, in the Haase clan, there were some brownish, quite like our family. There were some people who tended to be Nazis. Being Prussians, there were military, also military people on this branch of the family. I mean, this was a bit further. You say whether I knew that Paul von Haase was involved in the in the plot, in earlier time, there was just no contact with military people and our family. And then with Paul von Hase, the contact became nearer and nearer. So that would never happen if he would just be only a military. So that had some meaning. And I knew that he was against it. I didn't know what part he would play in a plot, but I knew that he was in this resistance group. This was clear without telling. Otherwise, he wouldn't have this suddenly nearer contact during the later years of Nazi.
So the full account you weren't perhaps aware of until after he was arrested and then executed.
Yeah.
One more quick question.
You mentioned that after the war, some surviving resistance members criticized von Hagenani. Was there enough documentation left for your aunt, von Hagenani, to help her answer that?
This was mainly that she knew so much, and the way she wrote it down, she only wrote very little. But that was so schlüssig, so conclusive, that she didn't need more proof. There were proofs just in these facts. She was very disappointed at, with how the things went. And she died very early. I think she didn't want to live anymore. Probably she died a normal death, but she was just 60, I think, or not even quite 60. And so it's not very young, but anyway, youngish, younger than the others. She just knew a lot, and if somebody would have, of these who had written that, would have attacked her, she could have answered it, so nobody really dared to tell her off point some of this, what she said at all.
Very briefly, could you give in one or two sentences your dominant impression of your uncle?
My dominant impression?
Yes,
happy?
Excuse me.
Positive? Like games, musical, of course, witty, never what some people may think, he was not very earnest, never teaching to us, not anywhere in the sense of religious education. When he was asked, my father sometimes asked him to give a little sermon on Sundays. We had a Nazi minister in our region, so sometimes he tried it, but then when Dietrich was there, he asked him now and then. He did it then, but he never would come just out of the blue with any kind of sermon-like thing. He talked fast. He was intensely listening if somebody talked to him, or they had an answer. Something like this. I mean, that I said already, that he liked games. I mean, he liked sporty games, but he was a good tennis player, but he also liked other games. He liked bridge, he liked chess. Played chess. He played chess with the nephews, but not with the nieces. I don't know whether it was conscious, but anyway, it was. So.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.